As I mentioned before, I really appreciate the sermonette that we enjoyed. People need reminders. It's just a normal fact of life. We set our alarms on a regular basis, and not just to wake up, but also because we have an appointment, or we have this or that we need to do. We post the calendars on the wall. We need these reminders. They're good. And the Sabbath days, the holy days God gives us, those are reminders that He gives us every single week. Especially when our weeks get so busy, they're important for us to have this remembrance to stop, the remembrance of what's coming next, the remembrance of God's kingdom. And of course, the holy days, we get to remember these times. Not only those days does God give us, but in His word, He gives us things that He wants us to remember. He wants them to remember in our lives. They may be stories or events. And this is something that we see passed down in His word as He's given it to His people. He commanded them to remember different things as they're going along. Remember this, remember that. And that's what we're going to cover today. We're going to cover one of these reminders that God gave His people, the ancient Israelites. So if you would, turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 4. They receive a lot of reminders in Deuteronomy. We're going to key in on one in particular, Deuteronomy chapter 4. And it's in verse 20. We'll read verse 19 and 20. Verse 19, Deuteronomy 4. And take heed, lest you lift your eyes to heaven, and when you see the sun, the moon, and the stars, all the hosts of heaven, you feel driven to worship them and serve them, which the Lord your God has given to all the peoples under the whole heaven as a heritage. But the Lord has taken you and brought you out of the iron furnace, out of Egypt, to be His people, His inheritance, as you are this day. God draws a distinction here for them, pointing out that, yes, all mankind enjoys the benefit of creation, and of course we shouldn't worship it, but them in particular, those Israelites, God did something for. He pulled them out of Egypt. He says, I pulled you out of the iron furnace. The iron furnace. He calls this, he refers Egypt, the iron furnace, several different times, and that's what we're going to look at today. We're going to look at this iron furnace. We're going to consider the conditions that they were in, and we're going to remember, just like God commanded them to remember. So let's turn to Exodus chapter 1. Exodus chapter 1. As we know, the family of Israel consisted of many different men, women, and their children. In verse 8, it says, now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Of course, we understand, we know the story, Joseph, his family, Jacob, you know, his father and all his family were in Israel, and Joseph had great favor. But here comes a new king, and he didn't know him. And this, we understand the passing of time really changes what people know, what people learn, what is normal, what is culturally appropriate. In Ecclesiastes, Solomon talked about the passing of time, and he regretted that he didn't have control of the future. He said in Ecclesiastes 9:5, for the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. And that happens very quickly. Yet as a personal example, my father died a few years ago, and my children knew their grandfather, not super well, because we never lived in the same state for very long. So they knew him to a degree, but not like me, not the memories that I had of him. Well, if time goes on long enough and they have children, their children will have never met my father. They'll hear stories, maybe, but the knowledge of who he was is quickly passing away. And if another generation happens and their kids have kids, they won't know him at all. Just gone. That's what happens with this passing of time. And so we hear in Exodus, even though Joseph was this man that was very well respected and appreciated, here we have this king. He didn't know him. He didn't know Joseph. So let's continue on here, verse 9. And he said to his people, this king of Egypt, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply and it happen in the event of war, that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land. So we have these Egyptians, this new authority, whether they are a new regime or just another generation, they were afraid of two things. They were afraid of the threat of the Israelites, the idea of their strength, that they could ally with an enemy and overpower them. And they're also afraid that they would leave. They wanted them there. They were a benefit. Originally, the Israelites were kind of in a symbiotic relationship with the Egyptians. They were good shepherds, and they didn't have food. So it worked out. Joseph had favor that they could come to Egypt and serve and also receive benefit of being there. But we're reminded in Genesis that this time was a terrible famine. And during that terrible famine, the people in Egypt, the working class, we might say, they were basically giving over everything that they had for food. Let's be reminded of that in Genesis. Let's turn back a couple pages here to Genesis 47. Genesis 47. And just we'll read verses 5 to 7 to see that, yes, this is contextually where the Israelites were in the time of the famines. So Genesis 47, verse 5. Then Pharaoh spoke to Joseph, saying, "Your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Have your father and brothers dwell in the best of the land. Let them dwell in the land of Goshen. And if you know of any competent men among them, then make them chief herdsmen over my livestock." And then Joseph brought in his father, Jacob, and set him before Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. So we see the family of Jacob of Israel. They were welcomed into Egypt during the famine, and Joseph being highly favored, he made sure it worked out very well for all of them. But the famine continued on. The famine was in process while they were there. So then in verse 13 of chapter 47, we read, "Now there was no bread at all in the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and all the land of Canaan languished because of the famine." As we know, Canaan was north, and that's around the area where Jacob and his family were sojourners. Egypt was down south. So over that whole space, there was a famine. There was a famine everywhere. And the point that I'm trying to highlight here is that Joseph's family was not exempt from the famine. They weren't spared the hardship of it. It was severe everywhere. Continuing on in verse 14. "And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, for the grain which they bought, and Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So when the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, 'Give us bread, for why should we die in your presence? For the money has failed.'" The money failed because nobody had any anymore. They had spent all that they had to continue to buy bread from the Egyptians, who had wisely stored it up because Joseph had been blessed to have an understanding of what was going to happen. I do wonder if when Joseph was storing this up, if he ever thought, this is going to cause problems for my family later. Or if maybe he wasn't too worried about it. God was with him this whole time. God would continue to be with him. But Joseph was facilitating this transfer of power. The people were basically saying at this point that they would give up anything to keep eating. You know, what good is our stuff when we die? And Solomon kind of touches on that too in Ecclesiastes. There's no pockets in the shroud. You can't take it with you. So let's give it away to continue to eat. And this really shows us the power of hunger, how hunger can really drive people to do things that they wouldn't normally do. And so we can look to a future event, you know, the mark of the beast, and see, well, maybe through the form of control, through hunger, you could really control a lot of people to do something they wouldn't normally do. That's kind of a separate topic, but hunger is powerful to people. So jumping into verse 16 then, chapter 47, 16. Then Joseph said, give your livestock, and I will give you bread for your livestock if the money is gone. So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for the horses, the flocks, the cattle of the herds, and for the donkeys. Thus he fed them with bread in exchange for all their livestock that year. Now this is talking about all of Egypt. So can you imagine how much they must have stocked up that they could not only purchase with food all of the livestock through all the land of Egypt, but that they could continue to feed all the livestock and themselves and the people for the whole year and more? They really had a lot stockpiled. Verse 18, when that year had ended, they came to him the next year and said to him, we will not hide from my lord that our money is gone. My lord also has our herds of livestock. There is nothing left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants of Pharaoh, and give us seed, that we may live and not die, that the land may not be desolate. Then Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for every man of the Egyptians sold his field, because the famine was severe upon them, so the land became Pharaoh's. So when the people had nothing left, they sold their land, they sold their services to the king. The power was all held by Pharaoh. He had all the cards. Verse 21, and as for the people, he moved them into the cities from one end of the borders of Egypt to the other end. Now, reading this from the New King James Version, it seems like a weird statement. Okay, they moved to cities. But here's a couple other translations. In the NIV, the New International Version, it says in verse 21, and Joseph reduced the people to servitude from one end of Egypt to the other. The Amplified Bible reads it this way. And as for the people, he removed them to cities and practically made slaves of them at their own request from one end of the borders of Egypt to the other. And the New Living Translation, as for the people, he made them all slaves from one end of Egypt to the other. You notice here that there's no exemption for Israelites here. There is an exception listed here in Scripture in the next verse, but it's not the Israelites. Verse 22, only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had rations allotted to them by Pharaoh, and they ate their rations which Pharaoh gave them. Therefore, they did not sell their lands. Then Joseph said to the people, indeed, I have bought you and your land this day for Pharaoh. Look, here is seed for you, and you shall sow the land. And it shall come to pass in the harvest that you shall give one-fifth to Pharaoh, four-fifths shall be your own, as seed for the field and for your food, for those of your households, and as food for your little ones. So they said, you have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants. So only the land of the priests wasn't purchased for Pharaoh. The people of the land gave themselves up and all their things, and they praised him. You've saved us. Thank you. We will happily give you 20% of everything that goes on from here. The whole dynamic of Egypt had shifted, had changed. In verse 27 says, so Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions there and grew and multiplied exceedingly. Now the reason I read this one is just to help us to understand that they weren't all good during the famine. This is talking about the narrative where they started. In Genesis 46:1, they entered with all the things they possessed, it says. They brought everything they had. They had possessions. That was at the middle, or that was in progress of the famine that was going on. This didn't stay. Just like the rest of the land, they couldn't maintain these things. They also were not able to keep up. They didn't have much. Now, it's good for us to remember why God sent them to Egypt. He didn't send them there with a command that when you go to Egypt, I'm going to preserve all your physical things. It's all going to be great. That's not why he did it. If we jump over to chapter 50, we'll read why. And in this context, this is, of course, the brothers worried, okay, Joseph is dead, so Jacob is dead, excuse me. Dad's gone. What is Joseph going to do to us? He's got all this power. And Joseph is, come on, guys. But we'll read his response here. It's a little more than that. In verse 19, Joseph said to them, chapter 50, verse 19, do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. Why did God do it? He did it to preserve life, not stuff. And that's important for us to remember. The Egyptians mattered too. God saved lots of Egyptians, but the Israelites were important to him. He preserved their life. And we, in this country and in this current age, we are very wealthy. And not everybody has the same level of wealth. But even my family, growing up, not having a lot, we still had plenty. We still had plenty of food. We still had plenty of clothes, even if they came from rummage sales and Goodwill and things, hand-me-downs from other people. We still had plenty. And that's abnormal when we compare it to other places. Many people in the U.S., poor or not, have multiple changes of clothes. We have wardrobes. That would be very uncommon in ancient times to have lots of clothes. Same with food. We have a lot of food here. If you don't have a lot of money for food, you can get food stamps. You can go to food pantries. Lots of churches provide food. They have soup kitchens. You can get food because we're a very wealthy nation. But that's not true with all nations. Many of us have vehicles. You know, Mr. Pettit was sharing how he didn't always have one, but you know, some of us have multiple. Some of us have recreational vehicles that really aren't even for a purpose of work. And we can travel hundreds of miles at a whim with relative ease. This is the country we live in, the wealth that we know. But that's not what's most important to God. He sent the Israelites into Egypt to preserve their life, not their lifestyle, not their things. He did it to preserve their life, and he would bring them out. He would deliver them from the iron furnace. But and they'd even come out with some wealth. They would come out with gold from Egypt, so he can take care of the physical things. But what did they do with that wealth? Yes, they used a bunch for the tabernacle that God instructed them to build and gave them talents for, but they made a giant idol. They did that with the gold. So the physical things are not where it's at. What God is more interested in is our commitment, our love for him. And he wanted to know that about them. I preserved your life. Well, what are you going to do with it? So let's go back to the narrative then of the iron furnace. We didn't get very far. Exodus chapter 1, we knew that there were a new king, and he was concerned about the Israelites and what they might do, that they might leave or rise up against them. So in verse 10, Exodus chapter 1, verse 10, come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply and it happen in the event of war. They also join our enemies and fight against us and so go up out of the land. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. It's clear here as we read verse 11 that the taskmasters were a new thing. The Israelites were part of what we might call a working class. They were already working for the nation of Egypt, but the taskmasters, they were a change. They were made to afflict the Israelites. They were going to have them do projects for Egypt. They built some cities and other things. Let's look at that word afflict in Hebrew. From Strong's, it's H6031, A-N-A-H, on-aw. And there's four definitions. The first one is to depress. The second is to humble, and that could be humbling oneself, which is not always a bad thing. The third is to publicly humble another, i.e. chastise. The fourth is to intimately humiliate, which is a euphemism, not good. And this sounds pretty bad, but it can be used for good. But surely the Egyptians didn't do this in a loving sort of way. But do you know that sometimes God does this to us? He afflicts us, same word. If we go to Deuteronomy chapter 8, we'll be back here in Exodus. But in Deuteronomy chapter 8, God uses this word. I should say Moses uses the word. Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 1. Every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. And you shall remember that the Eternal your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. So he humbled you, allowed you to hunger, and fed you with manna, with which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you to know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. This word humble here is the same word that the Egyptians did to the Israelites. They were afflicted. God afflicted the Israelites, but he had a purpose for this. He had a purpose. He wanted to test them, and he wanted to teach them that it's not about the physical. I'll take care of the physical. I want to see what's in your hearts. I want to know who you are. I want to see your commitment. I want you to trust me. I want you to remember what I've done for you. That's what God wanted them to learn. But now returning to Exodus, returning to the iron furnace, we understand that the Egyptians, they weren't interested in the Israelites' character. They looked at the Israelites as a threat to them. They wanted to subjugate them. They wanted to use them for their own purposes. Let's go to Exodus 1, verse 12 this time. It says, but the more that they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were in dread of the children of Israel. So this initiative to send out taskmasters to afflict them and to lower their spirits, lower their numbers, wasn't working. It wasn't a strong enough approach. The people were growing. They were getting stronger. Verse 13. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. My margin also says harshness. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar, in brick, in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. Now, we've all worked outside before in the yard or perhaps in a trade. And working outside can be uncomfortable. You get calluses or blisters sometimes. And you get sore back. You get cold or you get hot. It's hard work. But that's not what they're talking about here. They already had hard work. The taskmasters had given them hard work. This is far beyond hard work. This was nothing short of abuse. It says here that their lives were made bitter. Our lives are bitter when we have nothing to look forward to. Sometimes in the calendar, we circle the holy days, or we circle, you know, maybe it's a birthday or a national holiday like Thanksgiving. We have these things to look forward to. Their lives were hard. They were serving with rigor, harshness, and they didn't have things to look forward to. That was the life that they were in. Unappreciated, painful, difficult abuse and work. It's good for us to key in on this word rigor. We did with the other word, afflict, and they maybe are synonyms in our English language. But let's again look to the Hebrew. In the Hebrew, this word rigor is in the Strong's, H6531, P-E-R-E-K, Perek. And it's defined as fracture, i.e. severity. Severity. As we read before, at times God will humble his people, and he did in Israel, he humbled them, and he does that to us from time to time. He wants us to see our reactions, and he wants us to have a natural dependency on him. But does God ever use severity in dealing with us? This particular word is found only 6 times in the Bible. We read the 2 already of the Egyptians treating the Israelites this way. And there's one in Jeremiah we're not going to turn to where it talks about how the shepherds of God were treating their people with this rigor, with this severity. But let's turn to Leviticus and see another place where God uses this word. The Israelites are directed. It shows us that God certainly does not condone that people are treated this way. Leviticus 25, we'll start in verse 35. The title in one of my Bibles says, Law of the Land, number 4, Poor Brother. Leviticus 25, verse 35. If one of your brethren becomes poor and falls into poverty among you, then you shall help him, like a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. Take no usury or interest from him, but fear your God, that your brother may live with you. You shall not lend him your money for usury, nor lend him your food at a profit. I am the Eternal, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. And if one of your brethren who dwells by you becomes poor and sells himself to you, you shall not compel him to serve as a slave, but as a hired servant and a sojourner he shall be with you and shall serve until the year of Jubilee. And then he shall depart from you, both he and his children, with him, and he shall return to his own family. He shall return to the possession of his fathers. For they are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as slaves. God, at this point, does not condemn service or having servants. Even Jesus Christ said he came to serve. That was a role that he fulfilled. But he did say that you as an Israelite cannot own another Israelite. And a big part of that reason was because he said, I own you. God had bought the Israelites. They were his. So it wasn't allowable, wasn't okay for you to own somebody that God owned. So picking up again in verse 42, for they are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as slaves. You shall not rule over him with rigor, but you shall fear your God. So once again, we're back to that word rigor, that word that means fracture or severity. They were not to rule servants with rigor or severity. That's the opposite of what we see from the Egyptians in the iron furnace. That's how they were treating the Israelites, with this severity, because the taskmaster idea wasn't achieving their objectives. So they decided abuse would be the next step. God does not approve of treating people in this way. In the details that we see of God's law in the older sections of the Bible especially, we see all these laws that show equity and fairness and restoration if you do something wrong against your brother. You were to restore what happened and make up for it by increase of that amount. That is the law of God. There was no harsh treatment of others. Perhaps we would say the punishment was harsh, but that was God deciding what was just. In the society they lived in, slavery wasn't uncommon. And let's continue reading here. We'll see that God didn't forbid slavery. Verse 44. As for your male and female slaves, whom you may have from the nations that are around you, from them you may buy male and female slaves. Moreover, you may buy the children of the strangers who sojourn among you and their families who are with you, which they beget in your land, and they shall become your property. And you may take them as an inheritance for your children after you to inherit them as a possession. They shall be your permanent slaves. But regarding your brethren, the children of Israel, you shall not rule over one another with rigor. So we read that God will not allow his people at that point to serve one another as slaves because they were his. Now, we do know that God turns over the nation of Israel and later Judah as well into slavery for their lack of remembrance, their lack of disobedience, their lack of faith. But he told them that they were not to do that to one another. And notice in the verse 46 that it says that the idea of rigor is forbidden. And that, of course, applies to how you would treat an Israelite. But don't think that it also means there's a contrast here, that slaves were allowed to be treated with rigor. That is not what God is saying here. He uses it as a capstone. Rigor is not to be used, whether it's a servant or whether it's a slave. And to discern this, we need to remember the commandments that God has given and the law he's given. A quick one we could point to is the Ten Commandments. As we know, they're summarized by Christ into two great commands, and the second one is to love your neighbor. And Jesus gave us the example of the Good Samaritan and how he cared for somebody that he didn't even know. That's how we're to treat one another. We understand that we are to treat all people lovingly as God does. And so he says here, do not treat people with rigor. He doesn't have different rules just because they're slaves. Even if you were in this society to own a family as servants, you weren't to treat them with rigor. This is against God's way. It's against his love. It's against his character. Now, I'd like to, before we go back to Exodus, I'd like to read verse 55. Verse 55 of chapter 25. For the children of Israel are servants to me. They are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. I am the Eternal, your God. Just want to emphasize here that he was claiming rights on these. As we go back to the iron furnace, back to Egypt, the Israelites were slaved. They were slaves. They were forced into this labor. It was difficult. It was with rigor. It was severe. And that's the kind of treatment that God later will tell them, don't treat people that way. That is not how you treat people. So let's go back to Exodus then. Chapter 1. Back to the iron furnace. So in verse 13 we read, the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. They made their lives bitter. And this rigorous slavery, it was not accomplishing the goal, as we'll read. It still didn't get them to the point where they felt comfortable. The Israelites were continuing on. Slavery was apparently proving ineffective. So let's read verse 15. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shipra and the name of the other Puah. And he said, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on their birth stools, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. So in addition to the past crimes against humanity that Pharaoh, this new king, had been committing, he now adds the intent to murder. And he directs Hebrew midwives to do the killing. And perhaps he was telling them to act covertly so that it seemed that this was just an accident. We don't really know his intentions, but what we do read is that they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't do it. Verse 17. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but save the male children alive. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive? And the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. And so it was, because the midwives feared God, that he provided households for them. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. So the conclusion from the king of Egypt here was a blatant command for genocide. Now all the people knew that this was the law. Those little boys were all sentenced to death. And considering the consequence, we understand that that would lead to a mass reduction in the population of Israel, which he had been trying to do for some time now. So if you killed the generation of boys, then as they grew older, you would have a lot of women and not boys. And then that would affect the next generation because, of course, instead of having families, they never lived. They were dead and weren't able to. So that would affect multiple generations for a long time that those boys were slain. So this is a heinous environment that God refers to as iron furnace. There was genocide. There was wicked, severe slavery. Their lives weren't their own. They had no possessions. And God saved them out of it. He saved them out of this environment. And a furnace is a really good analogy because a furnace starts at a lower temperature and it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. And over time, the Israelites had the heat turned up on them where they actually had food and they were serving and it was working together. and then things were taken away. And they were forced to do things that they didn't want to do, forced into slavery, and then suddenly their boys were stolen from them and killed. This was the iron furnace. But God delivered them. He delivered them out of it. He did it easily. He threw down the physical powers of Egypt. He threw down the spiritual powers, whatever that was, make-believe and real. It wasn't hard for God. We're not going to go through all that God did. We know those stories. We've seen the movies. It's encouraging, exciting to think about. What is not is what they went through. But let's think about how long the Israelites kept that in mind as they were suffering and then freed. Let's look at Israel's lack of gratitude. We're going to jump forward to chapter 16 of Exodus. Chapter 16 of Exodus, verse 1. Exodus 16, verse 1, "And they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month, after they departed from the land of Egypt." As we know, the 15th day of the first month was when they were to go. So this is about a month later. This is shortly after the Red Sea crossing, maybe a few weeks. I don't know exactly how long, but it was a month later. Continuing to read here, "Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, 'Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Eternal in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger.'" I can't believe, it's hard for us to believe that after a month, when they were hungry, they already were looking back. They would rather have died in the plagues that God brought upon the Egyptians than to be in the wilderness and free, because they were hungry, because they desired the meat pots and the bread. And we can't lump every single individual of the Israelites into this group, but it was a collective voice as we read here. This was not uncommon. Now, those who were in Egypt, they sold themselves as slaves so that they could eat. And here, God frees these Israelites. He frees them, and he tests them, and he finds out that they did the same thing. You know, it's not even like they were fasting for 30 days. They came out of Egypt. They had food on them. It's just that their rations were running low. They didn't have as much as they wanted. And they were accusing God. They're accusing Moses and Aaron. This is an attitude of ingratitude. And this is a dangerous thing that the Israelites are showing us as an example. They were forgetting how terrible their experiences were. They weren't remembering all their sufferings that they went through while they were in Egypt. But God wanted them to remember. He was testing them. He had hoped they would remember. He commanded that they would remember multiple times. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 5. We have many examples of God commanding his people, whether it's Israel, whether it's us today, people through time, to remember him. Deuteronomy chapter 5. "Remember the things that happened to us. Remember the experiences. Remember the miracles," as we heard. Deuteronomy 5. Verse 12, this is within the Ten Commandments. "Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work." And then we're just going to skip down to verse 15 here. "And remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and that the Lord brought you out from there by a mighty hand, by an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day." So here within the very Ten Commandments, which we look as very foundational for, this is God's law. He says, "Remember, I brought you out. Remember, you came out of Egypt. This was meant to be remembered generationally because it's put right here in the Ten Commandments. Not in the first giving, but here in the second one. This reminder, pulled you out of Egypt. If we jump into chapter 6, when they're commanding them to teach their children, help them to remember these things regularly, generationally, in verse 20 here, it says, when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is the meaning of the testimonies, the statutes and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded you? And what a blessing that this could even take place, because this is a son asking it. The sons that were having genocide committed against them, but God freed them so they could have sons. And when your son asks you, what do you say? Verse 21, then you shall say to your son, we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. That's how they were to begin their instruction to them. If they ask him a question, you know, why is lying wrong? Or, you know, why is stealing wrong? You start with, we were slaves and God saved us. That's what God commanded him to start with. Them to remember where they came from. Remember how bad it was. Verse 22, and the Eternal showed signs and wonders before our eyes, great and severe, against Egypt, Pharaoh, and all his household. As we know, the Egyptians were dealing severely with the Israelites. And so God, in his judgment, he turned it around, and he punished them. And we know that vengeance is his. It was his authority that decided to treat the Egyptians the way that they did. And they did suffer after that. But that was God's prerogative, and he was going to put them down, and he was going to save his people. Verse 23, then he brought us out from there, that he might bring us in to give us the land of which he swore to our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Eternal our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as it is this day. Then it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe all these commandments before the Lord our God as he has commanded us. God had delivered them from Egypt. He first delivered them into Egypt to preserve their lives, and then he delivered them out of Egypt, also preserving their lives. And he gave them these laws to preserve their lives perpetually so that they could be onto the path of salvation, so they could move forward towards his kingdom and to be a special people for him. Of course, that would be for those that would obey. And this is one of several different places that we can turn to read that God told them to remember that they were in Egypt, remember where they had been. It was vital. But as we know, when we read, not many of them would. We saw a lack of gratitude for what God had done. And God witnessed this over and over and over because they wouldn't remember, because they wanted to choose their own way. Let's turn to Jeremiah chapter 11. Much further in the narrative, they may have forgotten, but God did not forget. He told them not to forget. Jeremiah chapter 11, we'll start reading in verse 1. The word that came to Jeremiah from the Eternal, saying, hear the words of this covenant, and speak to the men of Judah and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and say to them, thus says the Lord God of Israel, cursed is the man who does not obey the words of this covenant, which I commanded your fathers in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt, from the iron furnace, saying, obey my voice and do according to all that I command you, so you shall be my people, and I will be your God, that I may establish the oath which I have sworn to your fathers, to give them a land flowing with milk and honey as it is this day. Then I answered and said, so be it, Lord. Then the Eternal said to me, proclaim all these words in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem, saying, hear the words of this covenant and do them. For I earnestly exhorted your fathers in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt until this day, rising early and exhorting, saying, obey my voice. Yet they did not obey or incline their ear, but everyone walked in the imagination of his evil heart. Therefore I will bring upon them all the words of the covenant which I commanded them to do, but which they have not done. If we consider who he's writing to and when he's writing to Jerusalem to Judah after Israel had already gone into their punishment. How disappointing for God. How disappointing. He refers to the iron furnace where he pulled them out of, a death trap, where genocide was happening, where slavery was. He pulled them and he freed them out of there. And what was their reaction at Mount Sinai? Yes, they made a covenant and they immediately broke it. And all through the period of the judges, we read that every man did what was right in his own eyes. And we have those little bright glimpses as he went through of these different judges that did good sometimes. And then we have the periods of the kings and how many of the kings of Israel were good. How many of the kings of Judah? Well, they did have some good ones. But as we know, Judah would follow Israel. Israel went into captivity by Syria. That was harsh treatment. That was a rigor. And Judah would follow. They would go to Babylon. How disappointing for God that they didn't remember, that they didn't value what was done for them and for their fathers. Whatever reason they stopped disobeying God, stopped obeying God, whether it was because they forgot, because they just wanted to choose their own way. How disappointing, how incredibly frustrating for God, who wanted to have a family, who wanted to care for people, who delivered them from these things. Worse than just choosing their own thing, they desired to return to Egypt. What a kick in the gut. That's how Stephen expresses it in the book of Acts. We'll turn there briefly, Acts chapter 7. As Stephen brings about this history to try to convict and he to his own martyrdom their stance on who Jesus Christ was. Let's notice what he says about the Israelites. Acts chapter 7, we'll start reading in verse 35. This Moses, whom they rejected, saying, "Who made you a ruler and a judge?" is the one God sent to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush. He brought them out after he had shown wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and in the wilderness 40 years. This is that Moses who said to the children of Israel, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. Him you shall hear. This is he who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him on Mount Sinai with our fathers, the one who received the living oracles to give us, whom our fathers would not obey, but rejected. And in their hearts, they turned back to Egypt, saying to Aaron, 'Make us gods to go before us. As for this Moses who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him.'" That was a 40-day period, right? Well, we didn't see Moses in a while. "And they made a calf in those days, offered sacrifices to the idol, and rejoiced in the work of their own hands. And then God turned and gave them up to worship the host of heaven, as it is written in the book of the prophets, 'Did you offer me slaughtered animals and sacrifices during 40 years in the wilderness, O house of Israel? Yes, you took up the tabernacle of Moloch, the star of your god, Rephan, images which you made to worship, and I will carry you away beyond Babylon.'" We reap what we sow. It's just hard for us to fathom that after they came out of Egypt in those horrible circumstances that we read about, that their hearts were for going back. Instead of God and his good ways, they were stubborn and they wanted to do things their own way. Or they preferred the other way because maybe they had more personal choices. Probably the Egypts said, "I don't care what you do with your time, but accept that you're going to do these things." But they didn't have religious things they had to follow. But, "Oh, God's got to tell you what to do, so I'd rather go back to the other place." It's just, it's hard for us to fathom that God's way was not preferable. But we need to look at ourselves. We need to consider ourselves because we too were delivered from a spiritual iron furnace. That's the spot we are in today. And that's why this is so applicable for us. We have a spiritual allegiance to God for the same purpose that the Israelites did. They were delivered from a horrible situation, and God delivered us from a wicked, oppressive master that we know as sin. If you turn to John chapter 8. We'll read some of Christ's words here. John chapter 8, starting in verse 31. Verse 31, then Jesus said to those Jews who believed him, "If you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." They answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say you will be made free?" Jesus answered them, "Most assuredly I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin. And a slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever. Therefore, if the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed." It's funny in their minds that they were descendants of Abraham and said, "We have never been in bondage." And did they forget that they had gone into Egypt? And weren't we supposed to remember these types of things that we've gone through? But Jesus tells them, our commitment to him is made with that allegiance to God that we make on our departure from spiritual Egypt at baptism. We make a commitment to our King. We make a commitment to God, and we are no longer slaves of sin. We know that Paul likens the crossing through the Red Sea as the baptism for the Israelites as they were freed from Egypt. And we cross out of that reach of sin when we are converted, when we repent and we're cleansed by Jesus Christ. We are his. He saved us out of our iron furnace. Because while we were sinners, sin ruled over us, and it was harsh. If you think of the consequences of sin, they're harsh, they're not good. Of course, death, ultimately, consequence of sin. But sin carries its own consequence, and we all see it in our lives. Most of us have told a lie in our lives, maybe not George Washington, but many of us do, and we see the example and what happens in our lives when we tell that lie. It does not end out well, initially maybe, but it comes and it finds us out. Or what about adultery? How many relationships are absolutely destroyed when unfaithfulness happens? We see this culturally as if it's okay and it's celebrated, and we see it in media and different things. Oh, there's just relationships, you know, they get bored of or whatever. It destroys lives. Sin is rampant because there's a lot of slaves to sin right now. And we used to be too. We used to be, but we need to remember. We need to remember that we're not tied to that master anymore. We hold on to the truth. The truth has made us free. Jesus Christ has made us free. We're not to look back. Let's turn to Romans chapter 6. Romans chapter 6. We'll start reading in verse 6. "Knowing this, that our old man was crucified with him, that the body of sin might be done away with, that we should no longer be slaves of sin. For he who has died has been freed from sin. Now if we died with Christ, we believe that we should also live with him, knowing that Christ, having been raised from the dead, dies no more. Death no longer has dominion over him. For the death that he died to sin once for all, but the life that he lives to God." This is our example we have from Christ. We died in baptism to sin. We are to live completely for the Father, like Jesus Christ. Of course, Jesus Christ worked with God completely before, but for us, it's a change. We are now to be like Christ, who lives nothing but for the Father. That is who our Master is. Verse 11, "Likewise you also reckon yourselves to be dead indeed to sin, but alive to God in Christ Jesus our Lord. Therefore do not let sin reign in your mortal body, that you should obey in its lusts. And do not present your members as instruments of unrighteousness to sin, but present yourselves to God as being alive from the dead, and your members as instruments of righteousness to God." Just like the Israelites, we were saved. We were redeemed from an iron furnace. We were redeemed from sin as our slave master. And just like the Israelites now, we have a choice. Will we remember? Will we stick to our commitment with God, who's freed us? Or are we going to go back into sin? We need to remember. In Hebrews chapter 3, we receive another warning. We won't turn there. But it talks about the example of the Israelites and how they did turn back. We need to remember. This is a choice before us, just like the Israelites. We're spiritual Israelites. God is happy and willing to lead us, happy that he delivered us, just like he was for them. But we must not forget our delivery from the iron furnace that we were in. We must be practicing righteousness, actively denying the rule of sin that wants to. It wants to rule over us. We need to be remembering, and lastly, we need to be grateful. And being grateful can help us to remember. Being grateful helps us to improve our attitude. We have that same carnality that the Israelites did. So we have to be aware. We could fall into that same trap of entitlement and ingratitude that they had. But we must be spiritually minded and remain grateful for what he does. And we can see a good example of that in Psalm 116. So we'll end in Psalms. Psalm 116. This beautiful psalm describes a right attitude, and it's really a messianic psalm. That's what it appears to be, but it's a reflection of righteous, grateful attitude. This is an attitude that we should have ourselves, that we need to maintain. Psalm 116, starting in verse 1. Psalm 116, verse 1. I love the Lord because he has heard my voice and my supplications. Because he has inclined his ear to me, therefore I will call upon him as long as I live. The pains of death encompassed me. The pangs of Sheol laid hold of me. I found trouble and sorrow. Then I called upon the name of the Eternal. O Lord, I implore you, deliver my soul. Remember, we were also trapped at one point. We were slaves to sin, and that leads to death. But we had no hope for rescue if it weren't for God, if it weren't for his plan. Verse 5, gracious is the Lord and righteous. Yes, our God is merciful. The Lord preserves the simple. I was brought low and he saved me. Return to your rest, O my soul, for the Eternal has dealt bountifully with you. For you have delivered my soul from death, my eyes from tears, and my feet from falling. I will walk before the Lord in the land of the living. He's a slave. We were destined to death. But now we live. Now we live because of what he has done. We're freed, and we can be grateful. God is willing to lead us to salvation. Verses 10 and 11. I believed, therefore I spoke. I am greatly afflicted. I said in my haste, all men are liars. Verse 10 says, I believed. So here we have this admission of faith. So during the hard times, we can take our problems to God because we know of his deliverance and what he does for us. What can man do? There's a contrast that's pointed out here. God is dependable, but men are deceptive. Our carnality is especially deceptive towards one person, convincingly deceptive, we might say. And that's because we will most often believe a lie happily from ourself. Man is not dependable. We can't trust man. We can't trust in ourselves. There's only one that we can trust in. Verse 12. What shall I render to the Eternal for all his benefits toward me? I will take up the cup of salvation and call upon the name of the Lord. I will pay my vows to the Lord now in the presence of his people. Precious in the sight of the Eternal is the death of his saints. At baptism, we put to death our old man. We make a covenant with him. And as we know from Jesus' own words, that when a sinner truly repents, there's joy up in heaven. There's rejoicing. That's precious to God to accept that cup of salvation. Verse 16, O Lord, I truly am your servant. I am your servant, the son of your maidservant. You have loosed my bonds. I will offer to you the sacrifice of thanksgiving and will call upon the name of the Lord. I will pay my vows to the Eternal now in the presence of his people, in the court of the Lord's house, in the midst of you, O Jerusalem. Praise the Lord. If we have chosen God, if we have accepted the redemption that he's offered to us, and many of us have, we have responsibility. We have work to do. We made a vow to him, and we must continue to move forward with him. It's a path together. So with remembrance of what he's done for us and with gratitude, we can continue to move forward. Long ago, God worked with the family of Israel, maintaining his promise to Abraham. And Joseph, he found favor, great favor with Pharaoh at the time, and Israel was redeemed. They were saved. They had food. But as we know, a new king came along. And that new king, under him, the iron furnace was born. And Israel suffered persecution, slavery, and genocide. Now, we didn't read about the deliverance, but we do know God showed his ultimate sovereignty. He decimated the forces of Egypt. He plowed through them, and he brought his people out. And he commanded remembrance, but their gratitude didn't last. But despite their poor attitude, he commanded remembrance all through the Bible. He gave them multiple chances. What's recorded is Israel's lack of diligence. And it's really a sad story to see time and time again that Israel wouldn't remember their time in the iron furnace. But we, being delivered, much like Israel, under a cruel taskmaster from sin, who ruled over us with rigor and ultimately toward death, we also are freed. Jesus Christ came, he dismantled the rule of sin, and he has bought us. And he has plans for us. Will we remember? Let's move forward together, all out of this iron furnace. Maintain our gratitude toward God as we move toward the kingdom of God.